Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What made Gypsy Rose Lee such an American icon? This month marks the 100th anniversary of the burlesque queen's birthday to a ruthless mother who pushed her two daughters onto the vaudeville stage soon after they learned to walk. In the beginning, it was Lee's younger sister who drew the crowds, while the girl then called Louise Hovick was often relegated to dressing up as a boy and dancing awkwardly in the background. But as she reached adulthood, Louise broke from her past, reinvented and renamed herself, and revolutionized the emerging art of burlesque. Author Karen Abbott explores what Lee sacrificed in order to cultivate a devoted global audience and how her life remained affected by the secrets of her past in her new book, American Rose, A Nation Laid Bare, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee. Karen, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start by talking about the woman the world knows as Mama Rose. How did she set her sights on vaudeville as a way to support herself and her daughters?
Well, Rose, I learned in talking from June Havoc. I was the last person to interview Gypsy's sister, the late actress June Havoc. You know, Rose had some ambitions of her own, and when she was 12 years old, she was briefly allowed to indulge these ambitions and went on the vaudeville circuit herself, but her father put an end to that after one summer. And so I think she was a little bit thwarted and you know, of course, fixed her sights on her daughter June, who immediately proved to be a dance prodigy. She was able to spin on point on her toes like a ballerina by the age of two years old.
One of the most striking, I think, examples of the kind of parenting that Rose provided her daughters comes in the names she gave them. So she names her firstborn June, but when her second daughter comes along, she reassigns that name and gives it to the prettier baby, and the one born June is then called Louise.
Yeah, it was one of the more shocking pieces of information I uncovered. You know, their birth certificate, Ellen June was the name originally given to Gypsy, or Louise as she was as a child. 2 years later, you know, June is born, and that name is transferred. And to me, this was sort of, it really raised the question of identity. Here's something as personal and integral to who you are as your name being taken from you at a very young age. And this became a recurring theme to me. Gypsy was constantly reinventing herself, and when she the carefully crafted persona, the creation of Gypsy Rose Lee, you know, that was taken away from her. And she had to several times when her identity seemed to shift. And I think that, you know, started with her at a very young age.
Did Gypsy, as young Louise, did she envy the attention her sister got?
She did. Gypsy knew she wasn't talented. She couldn't sing. She couldn't dance. She was often ordered to play the tough character, hard-boiled Rose, you know, somebody who was a Bowery tough, as they called them. And I asked June Havoc about Gypsy's role in their vaudeville act. You know, one of their acts featured a dancing cow. And Gypsy, of course, in the musical, was always playing the back end of the cow. And I asked June about this, and she said, Gypsy never played the back end of a cow. She couldn't dance that well. Which also, of course, exemplifies the way the mothers Mama Rose turned her daughters against each other at a very young age.
Yeah, it's really striking. And the fact that the act focused on one girl and Gypsy or Louise was in the background. And the act evolved over the years, but there was never much attention paid to this older daughter.
Yeah, you know, and in a way, June was also jealous of Gypsy, though. Gypsy was very smart, and she had a little bit of formal schooling. June had none. And she read a lot on the road. She was reading Shakespeare. She was reading Balzac. And June, you know, also in the musical, she's presented as this sort of plucky little girl and who was a fluke success and who was pushed into burlesque. But I don't think that's true at all. Gypsy was a very ambitious from a young girl, even without the talent. And June said she would doodle one word, the word money, over and over again in her journal when she was just a girl. And later on, you know, money, according to June, became Gypsy's god. And so there was a mutual jealousy there. June really admired Gypsy's intellect.
So at one point, Gypsy was nearly adopted by an aunt and uncle, which would have seemed a much more stable life, and maybe this book wouldn't exist. Why did that not happen in the end?
Well, Gypsy, from a very young age, Louise, you know, her mother also conditioned her to trust nobody but mother. Mm-hmm. Mother was the only one that loved them. You couldn't especially trust men. And that was deeply ingrained in her as a young girl and something that I think she struggled with later on when she realized, maybe I don't want my mother as close to me as she is. And I think that she really desperately wanted to be with her mother and not stuck with an aunt in Seattle.
You talk about the fact that Rose said constantly that no one should ever lie or steal, but she did pretty much both on a daily basis.
Yeah, you know, Rose, both in Gypsy's memoir and on the, you know, in the musical, is presented as this, you know, eccentric, slightly pushy stage mother who's very ambitious and but not, you know, too out there. But this woman in reality was seriously mentally deranged. You know, she's somebody who turned her daughters against each other. She fed them on $1 a day while she herself carried $30,000 in a bag around her waist. She seduced men and women in equal numbers. She threatened to blackmail Gypsy for every dark and secret thing she did before making it big. And she literally killed more than once to get her daughters on stage.
Can you talk about what vaudeville was like in the 1920s?
Oh, vaudeville was fascinating. I could have just kept researching vaudeville. You know, it was sort of like the reality TV of the 1920s. Mm-hmm. only back then people actually had to work to become famous. They didn't have to just get drunk and roll around in hot tubs. But if you didn't have talent, if you couldn't sing or couldn't dance, if you just found something strange enough and practiced it, you know, you could become famous. One of my favorite vaudeville characters was a man by the name of the Amazing Regurgitator. And for his grand finale, he would set up a small metal castle on stage, and to the accompaniment of a drum roll, he would guzzle down a gallon of water followed by a pint of kerosene. And he would eject the kerosene in this great 6-foot arc and ignite the tiny castle in flames. And everybody oohed and aahed and worried that the whole place was going to burn down. And then he would eject the water and extinguish the fire. And he was one of the most popular vaudeville acts, during the 1920s.
Yeah, let's see Snooki do that.
Yeah.
Okay, so at 12, June has like a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
But Rose doesn't seem to have even wanted to pause to deal with that.
No, this was her meal shot. I mean, from the age of two, it's almost unthinkable.
Yeah.
June had the pressure of supporting her family on her shoulders. This was all up to her. And so if she didn't perform, they didn't eat, or they didn't have anywhere to stay, even though they were making astronomical sums of money. June, at the height of her career in vaudeville, was making $2,500 per show. Which is about $32,000 in today's dollars, and it was Mama Rose did not want the money train to stop.
Where did all that money go?
It's a good question. I asked June Havoc that, and she herself said, that's a good question. She said, I don't know. And my best guess is, the first thing is that their costumes were very expensive. Transporting the props were very expensive. The props themselves were very expensive. But I do think that probably a portion of the money went into banks that failed at the stock market crash.
So everybody who's seen the Natalie Wood movie remembers the scene where she sings The Little Lamb and she has no idea how old she is.
Yeah.
And that was real.
Yeah, and actually that was probably the saddest moment for me to write in the book, you know, when the real Gypsy Rose Lee is sitting and watching her Broadway debut, the musical's debuting on Broadway, and she's sitting there in the audience, and the only time she has a visceral reaction to it is when that song is played, and she begins to sob uncontrollably. Because she, you know, her mother changed her birth certificates aside from her name. She would make them younger for train travel and younger to get into the cheaper fares in the hotels, and then older to avoid child welfare authorities. So the girls really didn't have any sense of who they were or how old they were.
Yeah, it is interesting. You know, we think of this as being almost a lawless time, but there were people out there that were supposed to be keeping track of these children that were on the vaudeville circuit and performing, but Rose just essentially just ignored every law there was.
Yeah, there was actually scene in the book where the girls are stopped during a show. They're apprehended and the authorities come in and bring them down to the station and start asking them questions. You know, what are their names? What are their birthdays? You know, who is president? And just to check to see the level of education these girls had. And the aftermath of that was that Rose, the mother, was forced to hire a tutor who didn't last very long in true Rose style, but they had a tutor very briefly on the circuit.
So how did they regroup when, around the age of 15, June ran off and got married?
Well, it was a devastating, you know, suddenly their meal ticket was gone and vaudeville was dying. You know, vaudeville started suffering with the advent of talking films. Mm-hmm. You know, 1927 and The Jazz Singer was released and people started getting interested in talking films instead of vaudeville. And when the stock market crashed and the Depression, you know, came about. That was the final blow, and it was a very difficult year for Gypsy. It was a year right after vaudeville and before she was discovered at Minsky's in New York that she never talked about. It's not in the musical. It's not in her memoir. And they were desperate. Gypsy was eating dog food to survive. And both her sister and her son told me that she was forced to do things against her will and intimated that one of those things was prostitution. And it's a year she never liked to talk about and worried constantly that she was going to fall back into, you know, doing things against her will. And it was this time also that her mother drew from when she decided to blackmail her later and extort money from her.
Author Karen Abbott is my guest. Her new book is called American Rose, A Nation Laid Bare, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee. We'll be back to our discussion with Karen in just a couple of moments. Invite you to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 to ask a question, or you can also send one in through email to think@kera.org. Again, we'll be back with Karen in a couple of minutes. Right now, we're going to take a pause and talk to you about ways that you can support this station and make sure that public radio stays strong and vibrant in North Texas for decades to come, at least for the year to come.
Well, there are two direct ways. You can call 1-888-694-6931. And good afternoon. I'm Justin Martin, your
local
All Things Considered host.
Welcome back.
Or you can go to kera.org. Either way, the money goes directly to supporting the programming. It's tax deductible. You have thank you gifts you can choose from, and you'll feel really good about yourself when you're done. 1-888-694-6931 or kera.org.
Because we like to attach, you know, the theme of today's show to thank you gifts.
Indeed.
If you're interested in making a $120 contribution and you want to read this book, American Rose by Karen Abbott, we do have that as a thank you gift available when you make a contribution of $120. Of course, most of that money goes to supporting the programming you love. Some of it goes to the book itself. Your contribution is what we're really seeking here. Whatever amount you can work into your budget, we really appreciate your participation in the station. We are here because of you, and we're here thanks to you. The money that you send because you listen provides 58% of our overall funding. That's a huge amount. And I can tell you, it is not all fat cats that are giving us huge, you know, thousands upon thousands of dollars. It's lots of people just like you and me who work a job, who have a family, who've got stuff going on, but make a little space in their budget for something as important as the presence of vibrant, non-commercial public radio in this community. You can join that that legion of heroes by going online now to make a contribution at kera.org. I just sounded like Stephen Colbert there. Try to avoid that. You can also call us at 1-888-694-6931.
You know, you have an intelligent mind. You appreciate this kind of programming. And as Chris was saying, there truly, there is no insignificant amount. Whatever level you can afford, whatever amount you choose in conjunction with all the other contributions pays for the programming. And it takes contributors like you, listeners like you, to step up to the plate and contribute so we can continue bringing your mind this fresh perspective, this information that you wouldn't get anywhere else on the dial. You know that when another station is playing a large 23-minute commercial set, that you can come to KERA and you'll be hearing content. You'll be hearing news. You'll be hearing information. You'll be hearing entertainment, again, that's very unique. And it's been unique for 37 years, and it's your contributions that has allowed us to maintain this level. 1-888-694-6931 is the number you can dial. Or if you have an internet-enabled phone, device, iPad, whatever, you can go to kera.org.
Well, you know, Justin, you talked about switching over during commercials elsewhere and landing on public radio on 90.1. We know there are at least some of you out there that never switched back, that, you know, you got all the program buttons in your car programmed, and it's really only on 90.1 all the time. We love that, and we're so happy that you're with us, and we appreciate your presence as a listener, your presence as a financial supporter is the next step. And it is maybe a small one for you, but it's a really big one for us. And we really appreciate your membership to the station, your joining of the team that makes public radio possible in this community. You can do this now by going online at kera.org. You can pay for your membership with a credit card or a debit card. You can also you can also call 1-888-694-6931. Make a $120 contribution today or more, and among the thank you gifts you can choose from is Karen Abbott's book, American Rose, A Nation Laid Bare, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee. We'll be back with Karen in just a moment. Get in touch with us now at kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Karen Abbott. Her new book is called American Rose, A Nation Laid Bare, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Karen, Rose's plan during this what we now know is a time of great transition, initially was to use Louise, soon to be Gypsy, as still a sort of ingenue. And there's a great story in here of when she's asked to perform with Fanny Bryce, who was very famous at the time, and her costume is to be some kind of flapper getup, and Rose's worry, Gypsy's worry that this is not modest enough.
Yeah, yeah. Strangely, Gypsy was actually prudish in many ways. And she even designed her own burlesque costume so that she was never seen from behind. She was very careful about that. There was this one quote also that really struck me as giving great insight into the dichotomy between who Rose Louise was as a person and who Gypsy Rose Lee was as a creation. She said, sometimes I take a prudish point of view on certain films and people and books, and then I pull myself up and say, well, how could Gypsy Rose Lee possibly think this way? And so she sort of, you know, then confronted herself and said, I am a stripteaser. I can't really be this prudish. But she was quite modest, and a lot of that had to do with their mother, strangely, who, even though she went through men frequently and women frequently and got around in her way, her mother was also adopted this sort of prudish attitude to a lot of things.
Gypsy had also struggled with her weight over the years, and finally, I guess she just started dieting really radically in order to look the way she needed to look.
Yeah, there was. She had something called an essence mix, and the recipe is actually in the book of this substance, this little concoction she would drink. And she really started that when she became a headliner at Minsky's Republic in 1931. She was only 19, 20 years old, and she realized that her body was in part her meal ticket, and she had to sort of present herself in a certain way. And then the way she, you know, eventually expanded upon that was to become the intellectual stripteaser and added that to her persona as well. But she was quite concerned about her weight and never ate much during her life. She would just take a few bites of something and then throw it away.
So how did she start to stand up to Rose's ideas about what the act should be and say, no, it needs to go this way if we're going to succeed?
Well, she had that one realization when they were trying to do a sort of quasi vaudeville act, and when vaudeville was dead and burlesque was the only thing left, and Gypsy's idea was to sex the act up a bit and put makeup on these girls and make all of them platinum bleach blondes, and she would be the only brunette. And she, you know, was very innovative and sort of had and ambitious, you know, and this was what she decided to do. And in the same way, she would, you know, when the opportunity presented itself, she seized the moment, and she's the one who decided to strip for the first time on the Broadway musical. It's always her mother who's pushing her to strip, but it was very much Gypsy's decision, and she's the one who told the stage manager to put her name up in lights, and she sat down and said, I am a star. I can't sing and I can't dance, but I am a star.
And this is when she's calling herself Rose Louise and her Hollywood Blondes.
Yeah, it's right before the creation of Gypsy Rose Lee.
Where did that name come from, Gypsy Rose Lee?
That's a good question. Arthur Lawrence actually asked her this question when he was writing the book that became, you know, for the musical Gypsy. And he went to her townhouse on the Upper East Side of Manhattan to try to get down to the, you know, the bottom of some of the details that she's always omitting from her story. And he asked her, you know, how did you come up with your name? Where did Gypsy Rose Lee come from? And Gypsy's response to that was, oh, darling, I've told so many versions of how I got my name. Why don't you make up your own? As long as you spell it right. That's all she really cared about.
And you mentioned earlier that she was incredibly intelligent. She had serious literary ambitions, very close to the novelist Carson McCullers.
Yeah, for a time, Gypsy actually moved into a writer's colony in Brooklyn, and she was living there with W.H. Auden, Benjamin Britten, George Davis, who was the fiction editor at Harper's Bazaar, and Carson McCullers, who was working on the book that would become The Member of the Wedding. And she and Carson became particularly close. It was even rumored that they had a fling at the time. And Gypsy did have very serious literary ambitions. She wrote essays for The New Yorker. She wrote two novels, She wrote a play that was produced on Broadway, and of course she wrote her memoir, Become the Greatest Musical in American History. And she got a contract with Simon & Schuster for that novel she was working on there. It was called The G-String Murders, a mystery in which the murder weapon of choice is a G-string. and she told her publicist at Simon & Schuster, she said, I will do my striptease in Macy's window to sell a book. If you want something a bit classier, make it a winemaker's window.
Talk for a minute about exactly what went on when she stripped.
Well, it varied over the years. It when she first started stripping, she would be almost as naked as everybody else. She would be down to her pasties and her G-string. But the difference was how she stripped. She was the only person who talked while she was doing a striptease. And she had this incredibly witty patter that would go on and sort of spoof what she was doing as she was doing it. One of her most famous routines was called The Psychology of a Stripteaser. And it talks about how she had to go to Moscow at the age of three to study ballet, how she went to college at Sweetbriar, how she studied classics and painting in Paris, and how she read all of the best literature in order to properly learn how to take off her clothes for you fine people. All the rigorous education that goes into becoming a stripteaser. And she really, you know, a half century before Madonna, she understood how to make performance out of desire, how to exploit the very human instinct that we're always going to want most but we'll never have. And, you know, while other stripteasers were in their paces and G-string, but they were up against the audience, bumping and grinding very overtly, and Gypsy would back up against the curtain and stand tall and regal and unobtainable and say things like, oh, boys, I can't take that off. I'll catch cold. And it was something that people had never seen before.
Did she have imitators? It would seem like suddenly there's this persona that is doing so well that it becomes instantly famous. Were there 1,000 wannabe Gypsy Rose Lees?
Oh, there were. There was actually everything from people just spelling Gypsy Rose Lee differently to someone who called themselves Gypsy Rose Flea. and Gypsy actually, I think, half enjoyed this, but then she ended up suing a few of them. She was very conscious of her image and her persona and claimed ownership over that very rigorously.
Did she have plans from the beginning when she was doing this at 19 or whatever? Did she recognize that there was a sort of shelf life to the viable career of a stripper?
I think she did, and it was part of, she had a very tortured, conflicted relationship with Gypsy Rose Lee, the creation. She loved it for all of the things it gave her, money, security, independence, and some distance eventually from her mother, which was very important to her at the end. But she also loathed its limitations. Anytime she tried to be someone other than Gypsy Rose Lee, it didn't always quite work out as she planned. So she lived in this sort of exquisite trap she herself had set. And it was a source of both great joy and frustration to her.
She was really superstitious, is that right?
She was. She was born with a caul over her face, and which her family, of course, took to mean that she had a gift for reading the future. And in the scene in the book, there's a scene in which she's reading tea leaves for the kids on her vaudeville act, as she did often when they were on the road. And she sees at one vision of a boy in the act in a horrible car accident, which he's decapitated. And this vision comes true just a few weeks later, and she never reads tea leaves again.
You mentioned that toward the end she really wanted distance from her mother. I think you do a really good job throughout the book of portraying just how confusing and conflicted this relationship was. Did Rose love Louise and June, and did they love her? Would you call it something else?
Oh, that's such a good question. It's one of the things I wrestled with, too. June said that Mother was the love of Gypsy's life. And to me, I have a line in the book that sort of sums up the relationship. I say it's parallel to love and just as deep, but rotten at its root. And, you know, I would go to the New York Public Library, where Gypsy has extensive archives, and read the correspondence between her and her mother, a lot of which is reproduced in the book for the first time. And it was just the emotional whiplash back and forth, and the sort of, you know, her mother would write, "Dear Gypsy, I have a daughter living in a mansion, and yet you can't possibly, you know, support me. Where are you in my time of need? Are you a communist? I believe you are a communist. Love always, Mother." You know, and then the next note would be, "Dear Gypsy, I have been a very difficult, unreasonable mother, and I love you so much. And would you please just send me $1,000 so I can open up a child care center? Love, Mother." You know, so it was back and forth. And Gypsy, you know, a part of her always craved a closeness with her mother. And then the other part of her just realized her mother was, in essence, destroying her in many ways.
It's funny to think about Rose opening a child care center. That has to be the worst career
mission. And, you know, she was constantly threatening to expose Gypsy for all the secret things she had done on her way to becoming Gypsy Rose Lee. And and that haunted Gypsy for many years, too.
And then when Rose finally died, there was like a simple telegram with just a few words that said, Mother died today at, what, 4 p.m. or something.
Yeah, yeah. Gypsy kept a journal, and I reprint a lot of that, too. And she documents very clearly all of the care she gave her mother up until the time she passed. She put her in a very expensive home with round-the-clock care. And of course, Mother caused a lot of trouble at these homes and had to be moved around quite frequently. And when she finally died, you know, Gypsy marks down, Mother died today, and that was that. And Gypsy went to the funeral mass in upstate New York, and neither she nor June attended the burial.
Even after she was a very wealthy woman, Gypsy Rose Lee never quite got over the kleptomania that she was taught by her mother.
That's true. The mother was famous for stealing from other acts, sabotaging other acts by stealing props, et cetera, stealing, you know, various valuable items along the road and from hotels. And Gypsy, you know, did the same. And I think she tried to pass them off as souvenirs, but she would go to the finest hotels in Paris and liberate them, quote unquote, of their silverware and things like that. And that was something that she, I think, was passed down throughout the family. It was one of the family traits that was inescapable.
I think one of the funniest stories is when she's like an old woman and she's on Hollywood Squares and they have food in the green room and she like sweeps yeah. it into her purse on the way out.
She said that she was bringing it home for her dogs, but nobody believed that. They all thought Gypsy was going home to heat that up for herself.
How did the relationship change between Gypsy and June over the years?
Oh, you know, it was a very conflicted relationship, and it's very tumultuous many times. And, you know, one of the most poignant and difficult scenes in the book was when June is in dire straits, you know, there's a role reversal. Gypsy is now a big headliner at Minsky's Republic. 11,000 people a week are coming to see her. She's an international star or on her way to becoming one. And June is now, you know, anonymous and unknown, and she's working in marathon dancing. It's a horrible burlesque of its own, you know, dancing on her feet for months at a time for prize money. And Gypsy offers to help her. And you can imagine that the kind of help Gypsy might offer was not always the help that somebody might want or need, and sends her to a very unsavory place with unsavory people. You know, 80 years later, on June's deathbed, she mentions this story to me, and it was actually the last thing we spoke about. And I just was trying to comfort her, and I said, you know, June, I said, you were a good sister to her. And she said, I was no sister to her. I was a knot in her life. And she also, though, in the next breath, would talk about how she loved her sister and wish her sister could have loved her, and how much she admired her sister and how brilliant she thought she was. But there was definite hurt there, and I had the feeling that June was, in a way, looking forward to dying so she could sort of really gain some peace with Gypsy.
Author Karen Abbott is my guest. We're talking this hour about her new book, American Rose, A Nation Laid Bare, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee. We'll be back with Karen in a couple of minutes. Invite you to join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. Also very important this afternoon, we invite you to join this station as a supporting member by going online to kera.org or by calling 1-888-694-6931. Joined now by one of my favorite people here at the station, Justin Martin. Hey, Justin.
Thank you, Chris. Go ahead and do it. Become a member. Get it over with. We end the membership campaign.
Take it all off.
as soon as we reach our goal, we end the campaign. We go back to normal programming. And you're an avid listener, think you enjoy the program, know that your contributions support it. It allows us to get all sorts of wonderful guests that you listen to. It allows us to air topics that would otherwise not be airable on other stations. And you know that the thoughtful commentaries, the thoughtful analysis you get here, again, comes from your contributions. 1-888-694-6931 or kera.org.
You know, it's funny to think about, Justin, an interview with someone like Karen Abbott who has so much to share about the extensive research she did into the life of Gypsy Rose Lee. And if we had to do this in another format, I would probably get to pick out one sort of salacious headline item, yeah. And that would be the entire picture we'd get, which is, you know, not untrue necessarily, but it's not a complete picture. Of course, the really complete picture comes from reading the book, but it's nice to be able to have the time and the space in this format to really explore a topic and to, you know, respect the work that these people who come on the show do enough to really give it some time to be explained. Mm. We appreciate your contribution to this effort. when you call 1-888-694-6931 or when you go online to kera.org. Thanks so much to Mark Taub in Dallas and Matthew Gibbons in Fort Worth. Thanks to you if you are right now proceeding toward your telephone or your computer to make your contribution. Your amount is up to you. However, if you want to make a $120 contribution or more, you can receive a copy of American Rose by Karen Abbott. Really interesting reading. It sort of hops all about in time in an unusual way. So if you want to pick this up, but we do have it available for you today.
1-888-694, and I'm grabbing the book now from Chris, 888-694-6931 or kera.org. The book is interesting even on the cover. You can get that at the $120 level. And as you've heard so far, it's really interesting. And I know there's a lot more information in the book. Again, know that your contributions support everything here at the station, not just the fantastic program you have here with Chris Boyd on Think, but Morning Edition, This American Life, Prairie Home Companion, Radio Lab, The Diane Rehm Show, all of the stellar programs you hear on KERA together provide you with a very comprehensive understanding of the world and perhaps what goes on here in the community here in North Texas. Your contribution keeps that strong. It allows us to air these programs. It allows us to provide you this unparalleled access to this sort of information. And we have thanked you considerably over the years. We cannot say thank you enough to those who've contributed so far. We would love to read your name on the air. You can get your name on the air by calling 1-888-694-6931. Contribute at whatever level you're comfortable with. There is no insignificant contribution. You can also do that at kera.org.
If you trust KERA, if you rely on it, if it is part of the rhythm of your day, we would ask you to please become a supporting member. Don't wait for someone else to support the public radio that you love. Make sure that it happens. It's almost like, you know, when you have a restaurant in your neighborhood that you think is terrific. Part of the reason you go is to get a great meal, and part of the reason you go is to make sure that this wonderful local institution exists and remains strong. It's the same thing here. We are feeding you maybe not food, but we are feeding you with ideas and knowledge and information that we try to make as fresh and timely and appealing as possible. And we ask that you feed us back a little money so that we can continue preparing the programming that you really want to listen to.
Sometimes it's not appealing. Sometimes some of the stories are really hard to listen to, and you can count on KERA to deliver the stories, whether it's nice or not, and you can count on us to provide you that information. 1-888-694-6931 is the number to call, or kera.org.
That's a good point, Justin, because we are never here simply to feed you. We don't guarantee that you will like everything you hear discussed. We certainly are not here to convince you one way or another. We're here to present information, to explore ideas. It's a wonderful, we think it's a wonderful outlet and a wonderful sort of place for public discourse. Your contribution makes it possible. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go to kera.org. $120 contribution. You can receive the thank you gift of Karen Abbott's new book, American Rose. We'll be back to our interview with Karen in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Karen Abbott. Her new book is called American Rose, A Nation Laid Bare, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. There was a thriving sort of an intelligentsia in New York in the 40s and 50s. You sort of get glimpses of them. If you watch those old TV shows by Goodson and Todman, like What's My Line?
Yeah.
And it was, you know, we're talking Bennett Cerf, Arlene Francis. To what degree was she and her sister sort of part of that sort of exclusive group of people which sort of made up the intelligentsia at the time?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Gypsy was actually appeared on What's My Line. I have video of her appearance there on my website. June also appeared on What's My Line. But Gypsy's interactions and relationship with the intelligentsia, you know, began back in the 1930s when she was headlining at Minsky's. And, you know, the Algonquin Roundtable and H.L. Mencken and all of these people began to frequent Minsky's to see Gypsy Rose Lee. H.L. Mencken even coined the word ecdysias in her honor. And it was, you know, Gypsy's ambition to sort of be accepted by these people and to cultivate, you know, a more intelligent she wanted to appeal to all people, and that included the intelligentsia, along with longshoremen and socialites and gangsters. And even Eleanor Roosevelt, eventually, one of my favorite pieces of correspondence I found in Gypsy's archives, was a telegram from the First Lady to Gypsy that read, "May your bare ass always be shining." So
I couldn't believe when I read that. I have to tell you, Karen, I was. It's not something that a First Lady typically would write.
No, and they had crossed paths a little bit earlier in 1940 when Gypsy was headlining the New York World's Fair. And was voted, actually, the most popular woman in the world that year, even outpolling Eleanor Roosevelt. So, you know, this telegram, of course, came a few years later when the musical debuted on Broadway. That was Eleanor Roosevelt congratulating Gypsy.
When you look back at, I guess there is some film of her stripping available to see?
There is a very clean and abbreviated version of her most famous routine, The Psychology of a Stripteaser, and she performed this in Stage Door Canteen. It was a 1943 film. That's also on my website. And it's that routine I described earlier, and when she's sort of, you know, being this brilliant self-satirist who has this contagious delight in the comedy of sex and spoofing her ambitions as she's taking her clothes off. And that was a remarkable strip also because of her invention of what she called the inside-out strip. And it was this time when she wasn't stripping down to her pasties and her G-string. Instead, she would come out in these hoop skirts, this Victorian garb, and this big blouse. And slowly, stockings would roll down, a glove would be peeled off, a garter would be, you know, revealed and tossed out to the audience. But she would remain as dressed at the end of the act as she was in the beginning because the Victorian garb was still on. And this is something else that people, you know, just identified with her and became her made her even more famous.
Is it sexy when you look at it through 21st century eyes?
I don't know. I would call it sweetly sexy. And in the face of the sort of overt sexuality that surrounds us today and the sort of, you know, which I think Gypsy would think people were absolutely vulgar today in many ways, it is sexy and it's sweet and it's smart. And part of the reason it is sexy is because it's so intelligent.
So it would seem that she was very desirable to men. We know that she was married multiple times, but really couldn't make a success of any of those relationships.
No, you know, and again, it probably goes back to her mother telling her never to trust men. And the whole question, was Gypsy really able to love anyone aside from the creation of Gypsy Rose Lee? And she was married three times, and the love of her life, and I don't want to say she ever married him, was a man by the name of Michael Todd, who was a big showman and producer. He was from Chicago, and they had a lot in common. You know, he hired Gypsy to star at the New York World's Fair. And I asked June about the relationship, and she called it money at first sight. But Gypsy had relationships with people who would help her, you know, advance the creation of Gypsy Rose Lee, and a lot of those people included gangsters. One of her very first relationships was with a bootlegger by the name of Waxy Gordon, who worked closely with Arnold Rothstein, the mastermind behind the 1919 World Series, and that was a big formative time of her life.
And Waxy took care of her to the extent that he went, and she, for the first time in her life, she got to see a dentist.
Yeah, her mother never took her or Jean to the doctor or the dentist. When Gypsy was a young girl, she finally got taken to the dentist, maybe when she was, you know, early teenage years. She had 11 cavities, impacted incisors, a severe case of trench mouth, and she had these crooked front teeth that she made her have a slight lisp. And Gypsy meets Waxy Gordon one night at a speakeasy. It was her very first speakeasy. He sends over a bottle of champagne, which is her very first champagne. She's sitting there with her mother. And he says, compliments of Mr. W., and he comes over to meet her, and the next morning sends her to a dentist that was connected to the mob. And thus began a sort of quid pro quo relationship that was not as innocent as she made it sound in her memoir.
Talk about the most notable things that, having done your own research, she massaged or left out or flat out changed in her memoir.
Oh, I think the largest one is her mother's role in her life and the actual nature of her mother.
Mm-hmm.
June called their mother a beautiful little ornament that was damaged and suggested today that she would be classified as bipolar and have medical help to quote-unquote fix her.
Yeah.
But Gypsy, you know, made her mother sound like the sort of she made her a punchline.
Sort of
made
a
her
wacky,
funny.
Eccentric, yeah.
Yeah, and this was something that Rose herself objected to and took great offense at and was one of the things that was a constant source of frustration between them and animosity between them. But Gypsy thought she had to make her mother funny or else it just wouldn't go along with Gypsy's own story.
It's interesting, too, that she wasn't, she wasn't sort of built like a steamship in the Ethel Merman mold. She was Rose was rather a small person.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's important to note. You know, she was petite but ferocious. And she was a seductress and she had an air of vulnerability. And if she just showed a bit of that, if she just lowered her eyelashes and talked about how she was a woman in the world alone with her two babies to support, people literally fell at her feet and wanting to help her. And she had seductive powers over men and women alike and employed those to great use throughout her life.
I know that you got to know June Havoc quite well in the course of researching the book. And I have to tell you, there are times when she comes across as sounding just sort of bitter and angry. Is there a side to her that we didn't get to see in the book?
There is. I think that if June were bitter and angry over anything, it would have really been the musical. June Havoc hates the musical Gypsy.
Mm-hmm.
And here she is. You know, she thought it presented a caricature of the girl that she was and made her this shrill, bratty little person who wasn't really that talented, who was more of an untalented kiddie act instead of the dance prodigy she actually was. She talked about how her fan mail changed. It went from being, oh, you were so wonderful in vaudeville and what an inspiration you are, to, oh, what a little brat you must have been. We didn't know. We didn't, And the other component of that is that June didn't receive any royalties from the musical. And she's the entire first act, and you can imagine how she felt slighted. And she actually said, there was an example of my sister screwing me out in public.
Hmm. And she was there, though, when Gypsy was dying.
She was. It's after the girls decided to get some distance from their mother, that they were able to make some room for each other. They compared notes and discovered that their mother had two TVs, two radios, two sets of fine china, two fur coats, two of everything. You know, she had spent this lifetime bilking them both. And it was after they began comparing notes and getting a lawyer involved to create some distance between them that they were able to find each other a little bit. And June was there for Gypsy when she was dying. And I remember a really difficult scene in the book, and Gypsy's looking at her tumor. It's very prominent in her chest. She had lung cancer. And she said, June, isn't this just horrible? And June said, yes, it really is horrible. And Gypsy said, well, this was a gift from Mother.
Did Gypsy wish that she was... Did Louise wish that she was the character that Gypsy was more than herself?
That's a great question, I believe that's true. You know, I think that Gypsy the musical was not only her monument, it was her chance for monumental revisionism.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a way for her to become a Cinderella story when she was really a rags-to-riches story, and a strange rags-to-riches story. I like to call it a Horatio Alger meets Tim Burton. Jean even said, the musical presents what Gypsy would have liked to have been before the burlesque thing happened. She wanted to be this beautiful, romantic person with dreams. And of course, that musical does not present all of the really hard, the hard climb she had along the way and some of the really, really dark days.
Did this research change the way you feel about the musical forever?
It did. You know, I went into this book with no preconceived notions. Mm-hmm. I went into this book not even having seen the musical or the movie. Once I did, I just sort of made me feel sorry for Gypsy in a way that she had to completely rewrite the story. I felt differently for her on every stage of the book. You know, I felt incredibly sorry for her and for what she endured. I felt admiration for her for what she was able to become. I was terrified of her. I thought she would have been a formidable person to run into on the wrong side. I thought she was fascinating. I thought she was inspiring. I thought she was incredibly cruel, and I thought she was incredibly generous. So I sort of changed on every stage of the book.
Well, I think it all comes out in the book, and it's really a fascinating read. Karen, I really appreciate you spending this hour with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
The new book by author Karen Abbott is called American Rose, A Nation Laid Bare, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee. Thanks to all of you who have been listening this hour. If you would like to receive a copy of Karen's new book, it is available as one of the thank you gifts we have this afternoon. You can make a $120 contribution or more and choose that as your thank you. You just have to go online to kera.org. or call 1-888-694-6931. If you were listening in the first hour and you would like a copy of Half the Sky, written by Cheryl Boudin and Nicholas Kristof, that is also available to choose at the $120 contribution level or above. All Things Considered afternoon host Justin Martin is back. And Justin, it's been lovely to have you here the past couple of days.
It is. It has been an honor to be with you also, Chris. This is an incredibly compelling show every single day. And just as you were talking about it, we were talking about the show in the control room. This is just always fascinating. If you like this, and I'm sure you do, you can support Think with Chris Boyd at 1-888-694-6931. Online at kera.org. You can secure the books for $120. We have other thank you gifts you can look at. Most importantly, and I cannot stress this enough, is that the money goes to support the programming and keeps us on the air. 1-888-694-6931 or kera.org.
We know that a lot of you listen to the show live as it happens. We know lots of you also time shift and use the podcast. We are so delighted to be able to offer that to you. We really are. We love that it's got not only a regional audience, but also a national and an international audience. We would ask that if you're a podcast listener specifically to this show, you get in touch now and make a contribution because of this show. Now, if you happen to be listening to my voice saying this at 11 o'clock in the morning somewhere far away, I can promise you that the website still works to take your contribution 24 hours a day. The telephone number still works 24 hours a day. That is 1-888-694-6931. Your contribution is a vote in support of this entire station, but also specifically of this program. The Think is what you tune in for every day. Your support makes it possible for us to continue.
1-888-694-6931. Online at kera.org. You know, consider for just a few moments how long KERA has served as your audio oasis on the radio dial, the station you can tune to hear compelling, thoughtful information, stories that you wouldn't get anywhere else. And I know you've used some of this information in conversations or something that you've gleaned from this station has been involved in your life, and your contribution support that and allow others to listen to this wonderful programming. 1-888-694-6931. Contribute at whatever level you're comfortable with. It adds up. It pays the bills. It's tax deductible. You have thank you gifts to choose from. There's so many bonuses, but most importantly, it does support the programming and pay for the bills. 1-888-694-6931 or kera.org.
Big thanks to all of you who have supported us thus far this drive. We want to, at this moment, take the time to say thanks to Jim Traster in Dallas, Jan Steck in McKinney, Vanessa Foster in Fort Worth, and Russell and Jenny LeClaire in Plano. We would love to read your name next when you make your contribution. The amount that you give is up to you. Maybe it's been a good year for you, and maybe you can do a couple $100. Maybe things are a little bit tight. I always appreciate when people say, look, I'm not on a big budget, but I make space in my life to make sure that I support public radio, because it really speaks to your commitment, not only to this station, but to the ideas that public radio represents, that there ought to be a place in the media where, rather than screaming at one another and trying to make one another look stupid and foolish, we just want to talk to one another, to exchange ideas and to gain information before we draw our opinions. It seems so often these days it goes the other direction. People make their opinions and then they find some information to back it up. That's the opposite of what public radio stands for. We stand for respect and accurate information. We try very hard not to take a position ever on anything. Your contribution makes it possible for this kind of radio to stay available. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org.
You know, you add what you get with Think with Chris Boyd in conjunction with what you have on All Things Considered, Morning Edition, the local KERA news team. The award-winning KERA news team. You have the BBC News Hour at night. You put all this together and you probably have one of the most comprehensive news sources in the area that covers practically everything. I cannot truly think of another station in the listening area that has this kind of access. And we are so very thankful for your contributions for us to continue this mission. But it is absolutely vital that you take a few moments and contribute, perhaps again, so we can continue doing this, so you can continue enjoying these programs and having access to what we consider vital and probably what you consider vital also. 1-888-694-6931 or kera.org.
Think about this. If you were just to have to take out magazine subscriptions, Justin, to give you the kind of content you get on public radio. So maybe you'd have a news magazine for All Things Considered, and maybe for the Diane Rehm Show, you'd have another magazine, and for Fresh Air, maybe there would be like an arts magazine. And then for this show, I don't know what sort of all-purpose magazine there might be, but then in the afternoons, you have All Things Considered. I'm sorry, I was thinking about Morning Edition.
Yeah, yeah.
On the weekends, you've got Car Talk. Maybe you need, What is that mechanic magazine?
Popular Mechanics.
Sorry, you can tell I'm not a reader of Popular Mechanics. But anyway, you would get all these things. You'd get great content. You'd get a great variety. KERA is the whole thing in one package. Yeah. And we ask you to just have one subscription. And we call it a subscription, even though we don't cut it off. You know, at the end of it, we want to continue providing it for you. But it's a subscription because you are paying for the content that we send to you every day over the broadcast airwaves, or increasingly over internet and mobile devices.
Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, if the mailman bought you all of those magazines, you would hate to lug up 40 pounds of magazines. You get all of
that.
Don't
irritate your mailman. Just join KERA.
Just join KERA. Consider for all the stuff that you've gleaned from the station, all of the wonderful programs that you've heard, perhaps all the driveway moments you've had where you've heard a compelling story that perhaps was humorous or very sad that kept you glued to your seat. That's what KERA is about. We stand behind the message, and we know you enjoy listening. So do your part. 1-888-694-6931 or KERA.org.
I always like, Justin, that they're driveway moments without sort of the false tease where what you're waiting for wasn't actually worth it all along. It's almost always worth it to sit there in the driveway.
Yeah.
Your contribution helps us make this kind of radio possible in this community. You can do it online at KERA.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.